Hello, Catherine here. If you're listening to my podcast because you're a fan of wintering, the good news is that my new book, Enchantment, is available now. It's a book about how we can find a way to reconnect with a world that's sometimes hard to live in and even to find magic there. It's available in all good bookshops and please support your local indie if you can. For more information, you can go to catherine-may.com/enchantment. Happy reading.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
I'm Catherine May and welcome to The Wintering Sessions, the podcast in which writers explore the dark seasons in their lives. I realise I'd said the series had come to an end, but I hate uneven numbers and this one felt a bit like unfinished business as we'd had to cancel earlier in the year due to technical difficulties. So today I'm delighted to finally have Sophia Blackwell on the line. She's a poet, a radio presenter and novelist whose books include The Other Woman, The Fire Eater's Lover and After My Own Heart. Welcome, Sophia.
Thank you, Catherine. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
No, well, thank you for being patient. My technical klutzery got the better of me earlier in the year, so it's really good that we can finally talk. And we've got some really interesting stuff to talk about today, I think.
We do, absolutely. So I was reminded of my own dark season in my life, which was January 2010, when I was reading your book, and that was one of the things that made me want to reach out to you after I'd finished reading Wintering.
I love that. I mean, I think that's one, I mean, you'll know this too, but it's one of the massive privileges of being a writer, that people make links to their own lives in your work. And all of a sudden you get to see different dimensions in what you've said. I always find that so exciting, the kind of connections that it makes with people.
Absolutely. It's a huge privilege hearing about those aspects of people's lives. I never get tired of it myself.
It's really funny because when people write to me, they always say, oh, I'm kind of sorry for writing to you. You know, like they're apologising for intruding on your time. But I love that dialogue. I think one of the miserable things about writing is the isolation that you sometimes feel, you know, that you're sort of talking to nobody. And for the whole time you're writing a book, it's going nowhere. But then afterwards, you suddenly make all these links. And I just love that. Anyway, that's just my thing. So let's talk about that time, because you've got a fantastic story to tell us today. So were you in your 20s? Is that kind of right?
I was, yes. And my friends and I were talking over the weekend about sort of the years that we'd been happiest, which was an interesting conversation because we're all quite different people and we all want quite different things out of life. I was very happy from between sort of 23 to 25. Things were going very well. And my dad had always told me to look forward to 27. He said that was the highlight of his youth. Of course, 27 is also when
That's
all
so
the cool
specific.
People... I know, I know. It's like, why 27? Anyway, I was very excited about 27, not least because I just moved to London. I just got a job in publishing there, which is the industry that I have always worked in and still work in. But getting a job there when I worked in Oxfordshire was a bit difficult because it was sort of that time where being interviewed for media companies was a very impenetrable business. So you just sort of show up and within about 5 minutes you'd realise that you didn't actually want the job and they certainly didn't want you, and you know, you'd bought some new shoes for this and all that kind of thing. So it really wasn't going that well. But I came to London without a job because I wanted to live with my girlfriend. We'd been together for about sort of 4 or 5 years, and I was about to turn 27, so I remember my 27th birthday. And then about a year after we'd moved in and I was ready to start my adult life, you know, with the job, with the one bedroom flat and the relationship, you know, I thought it was all going to be smooth sailing from there. But it was not, unfortunately. So a year later, that all kind of came crashing down.
Yeah, it's really interesting talking about that time of your life, because so many of the conversations in this series have been about people's 20s. It is a time of such great expectation, but also such turmoil. Like, everything is unfixed. We don't really know who we are yet. We're often kind of still finding our way in careers. And I think that's true of our love life too. We're often in that process of seeking and trying to work out if this is it, if this is the thing that we've always dreamed of, you know.
Absolutely. And yeah, this is also in some ways the story of me finding out those things about myself that I had rather arrogantly thought were very fixed. You know, I'd always thought, you know, I had potential and I knew exactly what I wanted and who I wanted to be with and what job I wanted to do. And all of that was just entirely thrown into turmoil overnight when my relationship ended.
Yeah. So tell me about that. It ended for a very specific reason, I think, which is infidelity.
Absolutely, yes. And sort of the idea of growing apart is an interesting one, because we did grow apart, but, you know, that wasn't the main reason. The main reason was the infidelity and sort of how I felt as a result of that, really. I just felt as though, you know, there wasn't really any point to me anymore if I wasn't part of this relationship. I didn't know what I was for or where my value lay. And that was difficult. And obviously I had to move out, and I found a little sort of effectively what was a front bedroom in sort of, you know, a carved up Georgian house. In some ways it was the poshest address I'd ever lived in, but it was still a very odd scenario because it wasn't really a flat. It was just some sort of leftover rooms in between, literally sandwiched in between two couples who were lovely, two straight couples. But you know, they had proper apartments, whereas I was sort of like the weird girl who lived in between them.
Yeah. And those kind of places we find ourselves living in at that age as well are often not quite like home. You know, they're not the homes that we left. They don't have all the equipment and facilities. So let's just dwell with that moment for a while, because you said a really interesting thing, which was that you know you'd put all of yourself into this relationship and there was kind of nothing left outside of it. I think that's such a common thing that we do again when we're younger. You know, we invest in that being a couple as if that can contain all of us, and I don't think it can contain any of us really. I know as I've got older I've separated myself more from my husband because I've just realized I needed to. You know, it's not enough. Even when you're in love and you're happy, you have to have something of yourself, I think.
I agree, and you can't be everything to one person. You can't sort of hold it together on your own, basically. And it was an interesting time because I had invested, and in some ways, you know, I was running around town performing a lot, and my performance life and my writing life were kind of the only things that I had completely for myself. They were the only things that I kept separate. But at the end of it, they were all I had. So if I hadn't had those, then I really would have been starting from zero.
Yeah, and it must be quite a peculiar life being a performer. It's a lot happens in the evening, and yeah, it's a kind of interworld.
It is. So we're thinking about what's effectively a very liminal period, you know, living in this sort of glorified bedsitter with, as you say, you know, no no furniture or anything of my own, all of it sort of hand-me-downs from, you know, friends of my parents and that sort of thing. You know, I found the whole thing very humiliating, to be honest. And it was, you know, the stamina of running around town. You know, I was hosting nights and clubs and pubs all over the place. And, you know, there were some wonderful times. I got to work with some people who are now very famous and who are friends of mine and all of that kind of thing. And, you know, I felt very enriched by some of it. Like, there were some nights in Soho, which later in life I ended up running, but at the time they were a real sort of, you know, haven for me. But that also set me apart from sort of my peers at work and that kind of thing, because they had very sort of literally sort of very straight domestic lives, relationships, kids, and I envied that, but I couldn't actually show that I envied that. So they would be, you know, what did you do last night? And my answer would always be, you know, I was in a members club in Soho, or I was in a reggae sound system under the arches in Farringdon. And, you know, we had nothing in common. It wasn't that I thought my life was better, that I was better than them. I was very jealous of what they had. But it was just that we didn't really have much in common.
Yeah. And there's a lot of front to, well, I was about to say to life when you're younger, but actually when you're older too. But I think it's just that the front becomes different, you know. So there's all of that kind of, it's hard to explain what I mean, like the ability to present yourself as really exciting and really you're hiding something quite thin behind, you know, not having much money, not feeling like life is very permanent, but there's that pressure to make yourself look fully realized to everybody else, because otherwise it would feel quite sad.
I did, and as a performer I had to. When I'd be sort of hosting events and that kind of thing, you know, there isn't room for that thin-skinnedness. I always had to front. So yeah, that was quite taxing. And again, you know, I can't really imagine myself doing that now to the same level that I used to, in the sort of running around town night buses sort of, you know, scrapping around sort of life. But it did also keep me sane, I have to say, even though it was draining and challenging too.
And you're the centre of the universe when you're presenting and running these nights as well. People must have thought you were very, very important, which must have really helped.
I did. In some ways, I mean, I had, you know, really sweet people who would come up to me and go, you know, because they were quite challenging evenings in some cases. You're talking, you know, nine poets on top of a cafe or whatever. It really wasn't the glamorous life that I'd been expecting at all. But, you know, you're there. You may as well make the best of it. So that's what I did. And I'd hear people saying, oh, you know, you made this night with your emceeing. And I was like, well, you know, it's not amazing, but if this is what's on offer, then that's what I'm going to take.
Yeah, absolutely. And all this time you were working in publishing as well?
I was, yes. And like I said, at that company, I didn't really have all that much in common with my colleagues. I mean, we got on and we were fond of each other and that sort of thing. But I was just very aware of how different my life was. And, you know, I felt just sort of, a lot of them were engaged and a lot of the talk was about marriage. And I am married now, so I can, you know, I can bore people rigid as much as I want to about the details of my wedding favours. But at the time, I took it very personally. I just felt as though they were sort of laughing at me.
Yeah, and I think at the same time they maybe seem a little bit boring. It's that funny kind of mix of aspiring to have that life but also slightly despising it that I felt when I was younger.
Yeah, I wanted to have the option of that life and to choose, but I was, you know, my choices were very limited, as they are when, you know, as you say, money's tight, you're single, you're on your own. You become aware of how limited some of your choices really are.
Yeah, it's really true. And now I worry that, you know, what people think of me and how boring I am. And I kind of, I feel like...
I know, me too.
I miss those days when everything was wide open. But
well, there is that too.
Yeah. So eventually, though, you lost your job as well.
I did, yes. My job was split across two offices, and eventually they wanted people to stay in the office where I didn't actually work. It was not quite commutable, you know, those awkward distances that are sort of like 2 hours and something, and you just think, well, fine for once a week, but every day. And my colleague and I were both sort of potentially up for the chop, and I remember looking at her and thinking, I really hope you get this, not just because you deserve it more than me, but because if I get, you know, if I get to stay, then I'm going to be out of here. I'm going to be looking for something else. So, right, you know, I it might as well be you. And it was, because she was a much safer bet. I mean, I was a bit of a liability, to be honest. I don't actually envy the people who had to work with me at the time. So, you know, can't really blame them in retrospect. But
in what
it was
a liability? I bet you weren't.
I don't know. I mean, grief does weird things to your mind, really. That's the only thing I can say. It's certainly not something I have a problem with now, though. I mean, I've obviously still got my kind of artistic flaky side, but my short-term memory was very poor. I couldn't really settle to anything. And, you know, obviously I was doing my best. I'd always been very conscientious. But then I started writing a journal, effectively, partly because I couldn't really remember what was going on. Everything was so chaotic. And I felt like I was really living from moment to moment. So to kind of combat that feeling of, you know, everything being ephemeral and not really having anything to hang on to, I started writing about my life, which was very much a difference from the, you know, as you know, we're talking about kind of, you know, the writer's life and the pluses and minuses of it. I got feedback from audiences, you know, positive and negative every night of my life, but I didn't really create anything lasting. So what I did was actually move into writing what became a novel, which was another journey that I went on that year.
I'm so interested to hear you talking about losing a relationship as grief, because I think that's a very unstated but very common feeling. You know, we move on from relationships, even if it's by our own choice, but we still grieve that life and that self that was in that life. It's such a huge transition to make, and it's one that we are not really allowed to go on about too much, is it?
No, I felt very much as if I couldn't talk about it. So I certainly couldn't talk about it at work, and I couldn't talk about it while I was, you know, on a mic trying to hold an evening together. So it felt as though there were a small handful of people I could speak to. And, you know, sometimes that wasn't quite enough. Yeah. So hence the journal.
Does it? Yes, thank goodness for journals. And I think so many of us have confided in journals at different points in time. Where did you go from there? What was that period of your life like?
Well, January 2010, it was interesting because that was my winter, really. And, you know, pre-COVID, our lockdowns were very short. And this was a lockdown that lasted like a couple of days because there was this huge snow in January 2010. And I remember going to see a friend of mine that night, a guy who I'd met. And, you know, obviously I'd been what they call a perfect gold star for my entire life. I had never been with a guy. And on that night of the heavy snow, I remember going to meet him outside the station and seeing him walk towards me. And I just suddenly thought, like, oh God, I fancy you. That was really strange.
That's quite a surprise. So
it was definitely, because we'd only been friends up to that point.
Right. So this whole revolution's going on for you. I mean, it sounds very confusing.
Just a bit, yes. Yeah, slightly.
So I've never heard the phrase perfect gold star because I've lived a sheltered life. But that is, I mean, you must have been quite invested in that idea of yourself. It gives you a kind of status almost, if that's not unfair to say, that you're a kind of purity, a kind of ideological purity.
No, absolutely. I sullied my ideological purity.
So how, yeah, what... Did that throw you into a spiral of doubt, or did you just, you know, think, well, I'm trying something new?
It wasn't, you know, it was largely a positive experience. So there was a bit of doubt in terms of, you know, did my relationship end because I have, you know, straight feelings? Answer, no, that wasn't really a factor at all. Or, you know, what will my future be like? You know, would I be better off with a guy? Again, answer, not really. Not really prepared, you know. I mean, in terms of how I identify, the only thing I can say is that I used to be, you know, quite snobby about people who, you know, had both boyfriends and girlfriends, or who weren't into labels and that sort of thing. Because you're right, the term gold star does carry a sort of perverse status to it. And I embraced that, you know, it was part of my identity. But it was also a bit of a relief to get rid of it and go, well, everything else is up in the air. So why not this? Why not embrace it?
Those labels can be so rigid anyway, can't they? And so hard to live up to. It would be lovely to enter a world without these labels, but I think we're a long way off that yet.
Yeah, it's really interesting to see what's going on with young people today. When I was about, because I knew I was gay from quite an early age, about 12, and not everybody, you know, again, it's not a competition, but not everybody does, you know. Most people, it's later in life, and I was just lucky that I had gay people in my life as a child, so I had something to compare my situation to, whereas some people, they just don't have that, you know, point of contrast. So yeah, it was a surprise. And when I was young, I embraced those labels wholeheartedly. But as you grow older, the more you realise, you know, it's about people and about how these individuals make you feel.
Yeah. And so actually, is it fair to say that one of the ways you process that is by taking it into your writing?
It is, and bits of it are still coming out in my poetry years later, which is interesting. But effectively, I took the journal I was writing and I turned it into a novel called After My Own Heart, which is very much, you know, based on that time in my life and that sort of limbo feeling and sort of, you know, falling for a guy for the first time. And it was, you know, it's romanticised, fictionalised, you know, heroine's probably better looking than me and she gets up to more adventures. You know, that kind of thing. And, you know, I turned him into a bit more of a romantic hero, which he, you know, acknowledged once he read the blurb on Amazon and freaked out about it slightly. But in fairness, you know, everyone was a really good sport about it. But I was really paranoid because I had effectively fictionalised my life. So as soon as I had a publisher, I was effectively just kind of stopping in the streets and just going, oh, God, what are they going to say? It happened several times a day for years, and that they weren't really bothered is the short answer. So, you know, that's always what I try and tell people. But I ran up to a couple of authors who'd also written memoirs or semi-autobiographical works and asked just like, how did you do it? You know, how did you get past the guilt? And they were all, well, you know, I wrote it in the hope that people like you would discover my book. And that's what you did. And that was all I wanted. You know, the reason that I write and perform is to kind of make people feel less alone, to give a voice to the things they can't say. That's always been what I want to do.
Yeah. And I'm really sure there should be a very specific psychological condition called memoirist regret. You know, that the minute that you hand your manuscript over to a publisher, and I'm sure it counts for autobiographical fiction as well, you get that absolute chill of terror about what you said and what you've done and what the impact of that's going to be. And it only increases in the weeks running up to publication.
It does. I was an absolute wreck. But, you know, it's also good because I realised at the time, like, because my life was quite solitary, especially in those moments of reflection, and in terms of my relationship with the guy, you know, that wasn't a public thing. Nobody really knew us as a couple. And I was really worried that, you know, if we lose the few connections we had and if we don't see each other anymore, which we don't, then it'll be almost as if this never happened. And to me, it was too important to let that go.
So it felt like a very significant moment, even if maybe it wasn't the kind of thing you wanted to repeat over and over again. It's fair enough.
No,
isn't it?
I think it's, you know, it can still be significant if it's not something that, you know, you're going to take forward with you. To me, it's just something that I carry with me.
Definitely. So did that help to get you out of that lost period in your life? Or did you feel like that was almost part of it, that it was part of everything being up in the air?
It did help me get out of it because, you know, I had obviously a lot of anger when I was writing it. And, you know, there were times when I also found myself, I'm sure that you'll realise this too, but sometimes when you're writing, you end up uncovering things that you weren't aware of yourself. So
there were sort of things, yeah.
You know, it wasn't just about relationships. I had to sort of give my heroine a bit more to angst about because, you know, traumatic though it is, it didn't feel as though getting dumped was, you know, enough to sustain a book in and of itself. So she had sort of angst about her parents and her upbringing and that sort of thing. And that wasn't necessarily my angst. That was the most sort of fictionalized part of the book. My parents are still together, whereas hers are not, for example. But there are bits of them in those characters. And obviously that was a source of concern for me as well. But I found myself actually revisiting sort of, you know, what is it like to know you're gay when you're 12? What is it like to grow up feeling different? Does some of this pain actually come from other sources entirely? And, you know, so that was interesting. I found myself working through a lot of stuff through the process of writing it. So it was, it didn't deepen my sense of sort of being lost and in limbo. It actually helped me dig myself out. I also got another job and I moved in with some friends. And, you know, it was a bit sort of dicey for a while, you know, getting used to living with new people and also applying for jobs and that sort of thing. So it was a sort of up and down period in my life. But, you know, by pretty much, you know, April or whatever of the following year, April 2011, so much more of it was in place, including the book. And so it was, you know, about 2 years after my relationship ended, I woke up in the middle of the night once and realised actually I was over it, based on nothing. But you know how that happens sometimes.
Yeah. And there is a timescale to these things, and it's a year or two, you know, and there's nothing you can do to hurry that. There's a period that you have to live through and endure but you come out with knowledge, don't you, I think?
Yeah, I agree. You do have to endure it. But, you know, I'm naturally really impatient and, you know, I just wanted it to stop. I would have, you know, there were times when I would have done anything rather than endured it. But that option wasn't available to me.
Yeah, damn it. We're never going to solve that one, I don't think, unfortunately.
No, I know.
Putting yourself into suspended animation for a couple of years would do it for me sometimes, I think. Just like let all of this pass and I'll wake up when everything's all right again, please. You now live a really kind of very secure life, actually, I get the impression. Like everything seems very safe and controlled for you. And how did you get there?
It's an interesting one. I had other relationships after that of varying degrees of success. And I met my wife in January 2013. There's a section in the novel where, sort of based on me going to meet a journalist who was interviewing me for a magazine called G3, which was a sort of gay lifestyle magazine. I went to the pub. The journalist didn't actually show up because she was having a family emergency, but I ended up talking to a much older woman who ended up giving me life advice. And I thought, well, admittedly, that was an interesting and slightly strange evening. Why is it so significant? So I put it in the book, and then I finally met up with the journalist a couple of days later, and I thought, well, she's really nice. I'm never going to see her again because she's going off to America. But, you know, I hope that when she does come back, we can meet up. And then when she did come back to the UK in sort of, you know, winter 2012, January 2013, she asked me if I wanted to be hooked up. And so I said, yes, I was planning on, you know, joining Guardian Soulmates or something anyway that year. So why not? And she sent me a picture of Helena, who became my wife. And I was like, looking at this photo going like, are you serious? Because, you know, I will just have her right now. It's perfectly fine. You know, hand her over. It'll be great. But I hadn't actually been on a blind date before. I'd always been a bit of a serial monogamist. I hadn't been on anything like that since college. So that was fun. But yeah, as soon as I saw her sort of smiling in a coffee house in person, I sort of knew that, like, oh, OK, so that part of my life is, you know, 3-4 years later, it's over now.
I'm not going to let you skirt over the blind date that much. I want to know all the details. What was it like? Was it awkward or did it feel like coming home straight away?
It felt like coming home straight away. It was also helpful that in advance, Helena had been really, you know, she understood that it was a strange thing for me and that I wasn't really a serial data, so she just wrote, well, you know, if it doesn't work out, then, you know, perhaps we'll make a friendship out of it. And I thought, well, that's a really nice way of going about it. But obviously I was hoping for more. So, you know, when we'd finished having coffee and she sort of pulled a dinner reservation out of her hat, which she's still very proud of, the fact that she did. and the night went on for a very long time. I think I knew that, you know, unless something very odd happened in the next couple of weeks, which it didn't, then she was the person I was going to be with.
That's amazing. It's amazing to know that right away. Does being a little bit older change that? I mean, I met my husband when I was 18, so...
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, I've got no idea what it's like to date as an adult. I cannot imagine it. Like, we couldn't have afforded to go out to dinner or whatever. It wasn't on the cards. But I wonder, I don't know if you could answer this, but I'm genuinely curious, like, when you date as two adults, does it change the scope of it? Do you kind of understand the shape of a relationship more? Does it take some of the surprises out of it, or does it feel just as giddy and strange as when you're younger?
It's an interesting one. I had my first proper relationship at 17, which lasted for about a year, which I think a lot of people do. Mm. And in some ways, you know, it was a really positive relationship. My first girlfriend was absolutely lovely. And, you know, my only regret was that we sort of didn't stay in touch once I'd moved away. But yeah, in some ways, the best parts of my growing, like, burgeoning relationship with Helena did feel like that. So it was kind of like being 17 again. I don't really know if that answers it, but, you know, no, our sort of maturity or whatever, obviously we had things like, you know, Helena had certain kind of like family obligations and that sort of thing that, you know, we wouldn't have had as much younger people. But, you know, for the most part, it was really like being teenagers again.
Oh, that's so lovely. I love that idea. I love that you can return to that as a proper grown up, you know.
I know, and as we both put it, we would have settled for a lot less, you know. There was especially with the kind of, you know, addition of guys, both of us actually thought about, you know, would men be a better bet, you know, but we're really not cut out for it. It's, you know, we've saved men a lot of headaches by deciding not to go down that route, I'm sure.
I mean, I think that's romantic of you to both say that to each other. I can't quite decide.
It might not be. We just laugh about it now.
Yeah, there's that kind of practicality that comes in.
Absolutely.
It's just such a lovely end to your story. But before we finish, I have to ask a kind of nerdy writing question, which I'm really curious about, which is about you being a performance poet who also writes books. And so much of what you're talking about feeds into your books, doesn't it? You know, the, from the 12-year-old who knew she was gay right through to, you know, all of your kind of loves, and it all kind of comes into your very kind of frank, earthy, bawdy poetry that just feels like realness coming through. It feels like kind of real female conversation to me. What's the relationship between the kind of performance poet in you and the poet on the page? And is there a part of that you prefer?
It's an interesting one, and performance poetry remains my first love because of its immediacy. I do also love that you use the word bawdy. We've just finished watching Harlots, so that's very much in my head, being the bawd. And, you know, hanging around in those Soho members clubs, which, you know, largely used to be used for that purpose, was a big part of my 20s. And that's, you know, the surroundings that I found myself in. You know, we're very much like that. But yeah, I like the immediacy of performance poetry. Some of my friends and I were quite sort of precious about the fact that performance poetry had to exist in the moment. It was many years before I wrote any of it down. It had to be memorised and it had to exist between the audience and me. There were no transcripts of it.
Right.
So it was only when I realised that people would give me money if I wrote it down and published it in the form of books that I started changing my mind. But even then, I did CDs first. I had a homemade CD, which sort of was my first foray into publishing. So, and I know that people still buy them, weirdly. But yeah, when it comes to like the really extreme stuff, like the blood and guts, the things that you can't be nice about, I still return to spoken word because it's, you know, it's crude, it's out there. There's, you know, I'd like to think there's some finesse to it in the way that I do it. But another thing was that, you know, as you say, the book, when I reread the novel, I find again some of the people I was hanging out with at the time because of that performance side of me. And, you know, some of them are gone, they're no longer with us, or whatever, or, you know, I've just lost touch with them, or they've died since then. And it's just been really interesting to look back at it and actually find them or bits of them in the book. So it's like meeting an old friend. So there are areas where, you know, the two parts of my life intersect and are captured in the book. So, you know,
it's kind of layers of your own life, isn't it, and different ways of thinking about it and presenting it. That's so valuable to take it into fiction, to perform it, to, you know, write it as poetry. And also, you know, you take your spoken word kind of practice onto radio too, so there's elements, you know, different elements of you coming out in different ways. I think that's a great privilege as a writer to be able to do that.
Yeah, I still very much get off on everything as much as possible being live, but, you know, I am also an editor, you know, that's what I do. So the kind of liveness and being alive, remembering the line, not having the book or the phone stuck to my face while doing a performance, the words exist in me and they come out. And it's the same when I'm hosting for somebody else or whatever, you know, I want to kind of capture that moment and to keep the vibe going and for them to have the best time possible as an artist. Again, that's important to me too. So that is part of what I take onto the radio. But yes, I do also enjoy pressing the edit button afterwards.
Thank God for that.
You know, yeah. I know, as any self-respecting writer would, because that's when the control freak side of me comes out. Whereas with performance, you are flying by the seat of your pants. You know, I've done several Edinburgh Fringes, you know, and not much holds any fear for me these days.
Yeah, it's a baptism of fire.
It sure is, but I love the fire, and that's one of the reasons that I wrote the book.
Fantastic. And how has lockdown affected you then? Because actually the live arts have been very, very badly hit by lockdown.
Definitely. I very much felt for my friends more than anything else, because they had to experience that awful first 2 weeks where you're just constantly looking in your inbox and everything's cancelled. And that did happen to me. But, you know, on a much smaller scale, it's not my livelihood. I've never taken that leap. So I felt sort of grateful to have what I have. But, you know, it hasn't all been plain sailing. I've lost people. I've adapted to working from home. You know, and you know, Helena and I continue to be very happy together. But, you know, 5 months together is enough to make you think, okay, you know, could this be better? How can, you know, how can we improve things? We don't actually want to be apart from each other, but, you know, it's important to build in space for if we do. You know, I'm just trying to think, you know, what's autumn got on the cards? How can I make sure that I can keep some of the good things and the creative things from lockdown? Because of course I miss live work, and it may not come back in the same way. And you know, if it doesn't, you know, that's something else that I will have to mourn and let go of and do something else, because I'm not really up for the sort of half measures, sort of, you know, Zoom gigs and that kind of thing. Like, they're okay, but it's not the same.
It's not the same. I think we've all got loads more adaptation coming. It's really, I don't know, such a big transition to not. I mean, I'm an on the page writer, but I'm even used to having that contact with a live audience and having that live feedback and that feeling of contact. It's gone at the moment, and we're doing stuff over Zoom, but it's not the same. You know, you feel like the star of your own TV show, which is a very different feeling, and a feeling that I've never sought. I like that live response.
Yeah, me too. It's always been a big part of, you know, why I do things in the way that I do, and why performance has always been the number one thing for me. So yeah, it has been difficult to lose that, but I think it would be, it's sort of, in some ways it's a bit harder now to see sort of, you know, some of the bigger writers or whatever being able to sort of not quite resume, but, you know, you obviously don't get any fear of missing out when nobody's doing it. But at the same time, I'd still find myself doing gigs, particularly when I was hosting, you know, music events or comedy events or things that were a bit sort of like, well, it's not my career, is it? It's just something I do for the laugh. And I find myself thinking, like, you know, I could actually be at home writing another book, really. I haven't written another book in lockdown. I just want to say that's not happened.
Oh, you have been unproductive in lockdown,
I know,
have you?
It's terrible, isn't it? You'd almost think there was something really traumatic going on.
Yeah,
I have worked out how to make radio, though. So I've been making a program a week, and that has been my creative outlet, really. Obviously, largely supported by other people, but, you know, at the end of the day, it's still me asking the questions. So sitting where you are, basically.
Yes, that's it. I mean, we're all just talking at the moment and talking to each other. But I mean, that's something I've definitely loved. I mean, it's kind of nice because this is going to round up my series to kind of talk about this stuff, really. But I started the podcast in lockdown because I just wanted to talk to people. And I suddenly saw this tremendous opportunity to talk to all these fascinating authors about their lives and their work. And that's been massive, massive fun. And I love the way we have all chair swapped and found ways to chat to each other and found ways to reach out and make new connections. That has been a real privilege of lockdown. And I hope it continues afterwards, but I hope loads of it goes
Absolutely.
Away as well.
I agree. And I love speaking to people around the world as well. You know, I've had days when I've spoken to people in South Africa, in Brazil, in Florida, and to all kinds of places. And it's just been like, you know, I do want to retain that because, you know, but it is difficult, like feeling as though you need a pretext to reach out to someone. It's actually, you know, my friends who I want to check in on a lot of the time, really. So yeah, I hope a lot of it goes away too. And we can return to, you know, those people who you usually only see two or three times a year, but who you now currently don't see at all. They're kind of more on my mind than interviewing more celebrities, fun though it is.
Well, that's a great place to finish. Where can people find you if they would like to witness all of the wonderful things you do?
Mainly Twitter, which is where I spend most of my life. But I do also have a shiny new website, which is sophiablackwell.co.uk. And there you can also come across the broadcasts of recent radio shows, as well as links to my CV, links to the books, that kind of thing. So there's the website and there's Twitter. And there's anything relating to Out in South London, which is the radio show that I currently host on Resonance FM. You can join me there too.
Amazing. And I'll make sure I put all of your links in
Great. The
show notes. Thank you so much. Thank you for being patient with me while I klutzed up the tech. And thank you for telling us such a, I don't know, real and relatable. I hate the word relatable, but I keep using it. I can't stop. What I hate about relatable is it's reproduced in my mind like a meme. And now I can't stop using it because it's ugly, but it's so useful. But that's a side note. Thank you so much for telling us this just brilliant story. And
you're very welcome. Thank you for having me on the sessions. I'm delighted to be able to speak to you.
And that's about all for this week's show. Thank you so much to my guest, Sophia Blackwell, for sticking with me despite my tech issues. And this really is the last in the series, so thank you all for sticking with me too. I'll be back in October with a fresh new series of the Wintering Sessions. Bye for now.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.